1,000 imitated, never duplicated. This is the one and only Fash the Nation, your guiding light in a sea of degeneracy.
Hello and welcome to Fash the Nation, episode number 497. I'm Warren Balog. I'm here again with my father, Alan Balog. Can you say hi? Hello. Happy to be here. We are sans jazz hands this weekend. He is traveling, and there's a whole bunch of things that I'm trying to save topics that I know he's going to want to have a lot to say about. But I'm going to hit a couple tonight that I know he'll want to say things about that we'll need to expand on later next week when he comes back on. We're going to talk about the abortion issue somewhat, a couple of other issues that I want to cover. But first, I want to talk about J.D. Vance and how much I hate him. So, Dad, you were not aware of J.D. Vance. Who he was prior to this evening, right? I mean, when we started talking about him.
Right, yeah.
So, yeah, I'm going to just, for the benefit of the audience, I want to go through just a little bit about him. He just won a primary, a Republican primary in Ohio, and had the endorsement of Donald Trump. Now, a lot of people know who J.D. Vance is and what his background is, but again, since you didn't know, I want to go through it a little bit for the benefit of the audience. People are calling this, like Politico had an article about this election saying that Ohio was a test case for 2024. The GOP establishment looks screwed, and that essentially that J.D. Vance, who had Donald Trump's endorsement, won this Senate primary because of Donald Trump, and this just shows how much Trump, the Republican base, is still loyal to Trump, the average rank and file voter. And
but Vance opposed Trump in 2016, right?
Yes, yeah, he was I think a never Trumper, and we're going to go through his history real quick. He's 37 years old. Again, I'm just going to pull this up from Wikipedia. James David Vance, James Donald Bauman, who was born in 1984, an American conservative commentator, politician, venture capitalist, and author, and best known for his memoir, Hillbilly Elegy, that we were talking about a little bit before the we started recording, which attracted significant press attention during the 2016 election. And now he will be the nominee in the 2022 Senate election in Ohio. He will probably win and become a United States Senator, which is absolutely disgusting to me. There was a vacant seat there. Rob Portman was the senator from Ohio who was retiring, and he won the primary on May 3rd. So this guy, what I know him from when all the press was going around in 2016 and this book Hillbilly Elegy came out, essentially – he was preaching to the Silicon Valley, woke, corporate, neoliberal left that were all freaking out at the time about Donald Trump, and more broadly freaking out about rural and working class white America, that they're a bunch of racists, that they're a bunch of, you know, proto-fascists, that populism, in this case, like the same kind of populism that powered Brexit, is this toxic, racist, reactionary thing. And he came along, and there were a lot of, if you were following like NPR and liberal commentary during that period, there were a lot of people that were trying to write books about these people and saying that, you know, capitalism had failed them, globalism had failed them. I forget the name of it, but there was this Jew who wrote, she wrote a book. She was a Jew leftist academic who basically wrote a book kind of like explaining why these people would vote for Donald Trump and saying that globalism and capitalism had left them behind. And basically it was the left's failure to deliver on economic populist issues that allowed these people to be driven into the arms of the right. And that was a certain thing that was very popular among a certain kind of subset of leftists and progressives. And that was more like progressives wanted to hear that. This guy comes along, and he was writing to a different audience. He was writing more to the neoliberal class, like the woke, the affluent woke upper middle class. And he was saying, he was basically writing this book to blame it on them, to blame it on the working class themselves, to say that you're making a mistake by idealizing these people. They are failures. They are screw ups. They're blaming other people for their own problems. And really, basically, it's their own fault that they're so screwed up. And he would use his own life, which is so obnoxious, as this sort of success story about how he comes from these hillbilly roots, the working class background, the Rust Belt, Appalachia, whatever. And he himself rose out of that. And his whole book, I have not read that book. I would only touch it to chuck it on a big fire. I would not read that pile of crap. I might flip through it actually as the bonfire is crackling before I tossed it on. But I've read enough reviews of it, and I've read enough people talking about it to get the gist of it. And the you know, because even what he says in the book is not actually that important to me. It's what the media took from it, what the elites took from it, and what he peddled it as to the elites who were lapping this crap up.
I'll tell you what he reminds me of. You know, I drove a truck for years, and some of the worst dispatchers I ever had were former truck drivers. And you would think that a guy who was out on the road driving himself would be really sympathetic to the other drivers, but they were the worst company men a lot of times, because there's a certain type of person, I think, they look at themselves as if crawling up out of something, and they have a real contempt for what and where they came from.
Right.
And they go overboard trying to, like, you know, get in with their new level, and it's basically, it's like a traitor kind of characteristic. They're traitors to who and what they came from, and they don't look at the culture and the good things about, you know, their working class roots. They're basically materialistic, very materialistic people. They worship money and power, and that's the only thing that matters for them.
Yes, and everything about him. I even hate his fat face. I mean, look at this guy. So when all this was coming out, he wrote this book to tell the it's very much the old Puritan thing. It's deeply ingrained. I was talking about this a little bit with Mike, the Mike and Warren show. It's the old Puritan thing in America where you link success in the material sense with moral virtue. All right. Now, this is a very, very old American Protestant idea. And when I say Protestant, I don't actually mean Protestant. I mean Old Testament, Hebrew, Kike, Jewish, you know, idea. It goes against the basic principles of Christianity, of Christ's message, but it's something that with the Puritans and some of the other fanatics that were early members of, you know, formed the colonies and then formed some of the oldest families of the Anglo-Saxon elite in this country that then later had long before the United States was founded as a country, long before we broke off from the British Empire. This idea of these radical Protestant sects of the Puritans and this ideas like the doctrine of election, which a lot of like evangelicals believe in, where there's certain numbers of people who are God's elect who are just chosen. It's very, very Jewish. The chosen people who are going to get into heaven, and they're just picked ahead of time, and there's nothing you can do to change it. And the sign that you are one of the chosen is you do get material success. And this sort of myth is so baked into the American elite that, and it infects both the left and the right, that in the up to like the Roosevelt era in World War II, the financial capitalist elites, a lot of them were like Presbyterians. You know, they built these huge, gigantic Presbyterian churches that would just be a congregating point for like the wealthy elites. And since then, what's happened is they've been completely supplanted by the Jews and replaced. And the Jews have taken over like the Ivy League institutions where all this sort of wealthy Protestant idea was. And what's happened is that white elite, what's left of it, completely dropped their religious ideas. So they had this facade of religiosity that around the time of the 1960s started to go away, and since then the counterculture has completely gone away. So now the white elites are still a completely secular, I mean, they're totally secular now, almost anti-religious, but they have kept that basic moral posture. And this is what is behind SJWs and wokeism and all this, all the crap that we see, you know, the cult of Martin Luther King, the fact that I was just talking to a friend of mine and we were discussing how Black Lives Matter, the city that he's living in now, there's Black Lives Matter flags and signs everywhere in like the most in the wealthiest parts of town. I noticed that in Pittsburgh. You go to all the working class neighborhoods, even the black neighborhoods, you don't see Black Lives Matter signs or posters. But if you go to the wealthy areas, then you see them and the rainbow flags. So what happened was this white capitalist elite in the United States, that's very influenced by this sort of Anglo-Saxon Protestantism, they dropped the religious facade, but they kept the moral posture, the moralistic posture. And really what it is, I mean, I bring it back to Jack London in The Iron Heel. There's this amazing section in that book, which if anyone in this audience has not read The Iron Heel, go and read it. It was William Pierce used to sell it. It was his template for the Turner Diaries. In fact, the Turner Diaries is sort of like a white nationalist parody of The Iron Heel. But Pierce admired Jack London. Jack London was a great self-made man, one of the greatest, probably the greatest American writer, in my opinion. He was a socialist back from the days when socialism didn't necessarily mean all the stuff we associate with it. He was kind of proto-fascist in a lot of ways, and modern socialists and communists tend to disavow him because he had some strong racialist opinions and some very Nietzschean ideas about survival of the fittest. But Jack London wrote this book. It was a dystopia in the style of 1984 or Brave New World called The Iron Heel. He wrote it in around, like, 1907, and it's about a plutocratic takeover of the United States, an oligarchy from the robber baron era, and then about a band of socialists who at first try to fight it peacefully and then are forced underground and then have to fight it violently. But in some ways, it's more prophetic than either 1984 or Brave New World in terms of predicting what will become the future of the United States as far as it's being ruled by an oligarchy, a plutocracy. But there's an amazing chapter in that book that I never, ever, ever have forgotten, where there's this woman who, the hero of the book, he's this very rough and tumble, two-fisted socialist, but he's very brilliant. He actually, his character reminds me of a Stryker a little bit. I always, like, ever since I met Stryker, I'm reminded of this character. His name is Ernst Everhart in the book, because he's like a working class guy, but he's really, really smart. And he's able to beat a lot of these defenders of the system in debates. So anyway, what happens is he's courting this girl who is a daughter of the upper classes. And she's very idealistic and wants to believe in the system. And he's telling her how rotten the system is and just how screwed up it is. And he uses the example of this worker who lost his arm in an injury in a factory. I think his name is Jackson. The name of the chapter is Jackson's Arm, and then it's the chapter after that, where what happens is he's trying to red pill her, essentially, on how thoroughly rotten the system is. And he says, well, look, you go and investigate the case yourself about how this guy was mistreated. So she starts talking to all the different people involved. the people that got him like this crummy, basically no settlement. Like he lost his job because he lost his arm in a piece of machinery, and the lawyers for the corporation said it was his own fault, and so he wasn't entitled to any kind of support. And back then, this was before, you know, disability payments. And so the guy is screwed, and she's going up the chain talking to managers and bosses and lawyers, finally the corporation's lawyer. And she keeps going up the chain talking to different people about this guy's case. And the ones at the bottom feel guilty about what happened because they know, like the boss or the lawyer that defended him, they know they kind of threw the guy's case. They knew that there were moneyed interests involved, and they just screwed this guy over. But what's amazing is the higher she goes in talking to people, the more the moral certainty that they're in the right kicks in, until finally she talks to the bosses and the owners of the factories themselves, and they have complete like moral self-justification that this guy, they're in the right, they did nothing wrong. And then she talks to the wives of those guys, and they are the most morally convinced at all. It's an amazing chapter because it just shows how, again, that's like more than 100 years ago, but in the system of robber baron capitalism in the United States, the higher you go up the chain, you don't only find someone who is benefiting from the terrible things happening beneath them, but you find this sort of high-handed moral justification for why they're on top and why they are not just like better in a survival of the fittest sense, like they're biologically superior, you know, like, you know, the way Nazism, that's not actual Nazi beliefs, but the way Nazism is characterized, that Nazis believe that the strong should rule. But with American capitalist elites, it's not simply that they believe themselves to be stronger in a Nietzschean amoral sense, because Nietzsche is amoralism. No, it's in a very sort of hyper-Christianized moral sense that that's the reason why they're on top.
Well, what they've managed to do is rationalize the classic Christian sins of greed, lust, envy, all these things. They've done a flip, and it's not, whatever you think of Christianity, it's not true Christianity. And they made a virtue out of what true Christianity considers to be sin.
Yes, exactly. And so this streak of moralism combined with hyper greed and hyper materialism and just the most kind of crass, just accumulating wealth at all costs, this is still extremely present in American elites. The Nazis knew this. They went after it, the way American elites view themselves. There's wartime essays on that calvin.edu site, the German propaganda archive, if you look it up on Google, where you can find them talking about this Puritan strain in American thinking. And this explains the psychology of woke capital. This is essentially what it is. It's appealing to the same old thing. It's just now that instead of it being dressed up in like the Protestant work ethic, which is what it was before, oh, well, we work harder, we're thriftier, we're this or that, we're, you know, we do more for society. Now it's shifted to, oh, well, we care more about fags and trannies, and we signal more about blacks. I mean, Biden right now, perfect example of it. Biden is has replaced his spokeswoman, the White House press secretary, with this new negress that we can talk about on another. We'll talk jazz. I'm sure we'll want to talk about that on another show. But she's being touted as the first black White House press secretary and the first lesbian White House press secretary.
You know, it's just a distraction to take the attention away from this Jewish cabinet. I mean, it's the most Jewish administration ever. So, you know, a lot of talk about a black lesbian, and people aren't talking about all these Jews.
Well, it's almost more than a distraction because it's a justification for how it's like saying that, you know, as this economy, the rich get richer, no matter what. Even with a Democrat and all Democrats in who are not supposed to be doing that, But by doing this, it's like, it's not just, hey, look over here. It's you see how we are, in fact, more moral, you know, so this justifies what we're doing. So to bring it back to J.D. Vance, he wrote this memoir that is appealing exactly to that streak in American politics. This isn't, it's the opposite of the hand-wringing progressives who were like, oh, wow, see how you know, we've failed these white working class rubes, and we should look down on them, sure, but we shouldn't despise them because it's not totally their fault. Capitalism, globalism left behind, and we need to sell them on the benefits of equality and multiculturalism and internationalism and globalism and all the rest of it. And we have to give them a little bit of the benefits, and that way they won't be tempted by demagogues like Donald Trump or populist, inappropriate populist rage expression like Brexit. This guy's taking the opposite point of view, and he's saying, no, guess what? They live in filth, and it's because they choose to live in filth. And the reason you, Silicon Valley elites, have the wealth that you do is because you are morally superior to these people. So I'll show you how – because I want to go through, and I want the audience to see this, how this guy did this. So he basically – he's a Scotch-Irish descent Middletown, Ohio, between Cincinnati and Dayton. And his mother and father divorced when he was a toddler. He was adopted by his mother's third husband. They were raised him and his sister were raised primarily by their by his grandparents. And then he went to high school, public school, then enlisted in the Marine Corps, served in the Iraq War, and performed public affairs activities. And then graduated summa cum laude from Ohio State University with a Bachelor of Arts degree in political science and philosophy. And then while at Ohio State, worked for Republican Ohio State Senator Bob Shuler. And after graduating from Ohio State, Vance earned a Juris Doctor degree from Yale Law School. During his first year at Yale, his mentor and professor, Amy Chua, convinced him to write his memoir. And Amy Chua is a very interesting person that I want to talk about on a different episode. But anyway, so he started work at a corporate law firm. And then he moved to San Francisco to work in the technology industry. And serves as a principal at Peter Thiel's venture capital firm, Mithril Capital. And then this is what it says. In 2016, Harper published his book, Hillbilly Elegy, a memoir of a family and culture in crisis. It was on the New York Times bestseller list in 2016 and 2017. So this was the height of the neoliberal, upper middle class, white SJW angst over Trump. And the big scare with Charlottesville and everything else. Won all kinds of awards. The New York Times called it one of the six best books to help understand Trump's win. The Washington Post called him the voice of the Rust Belt. Okay? I mean, like, this would basically, if we took power and like, you know, a black guy comes along and writes a book and says, you know what, black people are stupid, they have low IQ, and that's why they were enslaved in the first place, was because they were dumb, they were the worst, dumbest blacks in the Congo, that's why they got enslaved, and then they came over here, and they were still dumb and violent and stupid, and that's why they always, you know, on welfare and everything else, and you know, like a newspaper emblazoned with swastikas says, oh, this guy is the voice of black America, you know. He speaks for the blacks, you know. So the New Republic criticized him, and this is perfect, as liberal media's favorite white trash splainer. So explaining white trash to the elites.
He's a white Uncle Tom.
Yeah, the false prophet of blue America. And anyway, so then he moved to Ohio to start a nonprofit, potentially run for office. And anyway, thoroughly disgusting individual, venture capitalist, Silicon Valley guy. He's one of the few, like probably the only white guy at Yale, you know, the only like white male from this thing at Yale. And the interesting thing about him also is that he, you know, he's founding these capital firms. I mean, and then he married an Indian woman, which I thought was really, really interesting because – yeah, here it is. Vance has been married to a former law school classmate, Usha Chilukuri Vance, since 2014, and they have three children. And he's been raised in a, quote, conservative evangelical branch of Protestantism. So literally, I didn't know that, but literally this is exactly what I'm saying. So this guy is a actual direct representative of this brand of moralizing capitalism. So the thing is, basically, his wife is an Indian, is a, like, the talented, you know, 10th or the talented 1% or whatever. She is the classic, like, educated elite Pajit, Silicon Valley Pajit. And that's the funny thing about this guy, is that the way I see that, that also was a choice. I mean, this is a guy who's making political choices his whole life. That also was a choice. So this man who's speaking for all the whites right in the Rust Belt and in Middle America, the working class whites, he marries an Indian woman so that he can have non-white, like, half Indian kids that are truly like global citizens. I mean, he literally has transformed his bloodline into a Kamala Harris, global elite neoliberal race. Total scumbag. And then the entry on Hillbilly Elegy, which was actually turned into a film. I haven't even watched the film either. I probably will watch the film at some point because I'm thinking about this guy again. But he talks about the Appalachian values of his family that include traits like loyalty and love of country, despite social issues including violence and verbal abuse. He recounts his grandparents' alcoholism and abuse and his unstable mother's history of drug addictions and failed relationships. So you see how this works? It's like, oh, they had good qualities. They were loyal and, you know, good folk, simple, nice folk, but they also were alcoholics and drug addicts and abusive and scum and white niggers, basically. That's what he's saying. And then he alongside his personal history, he raises questions such as the responsibility of his family and people for their own misfortune. There it is. They are responsible. So he's going to these Jews and globalists and super capitalists in Silicon Valley and saying, don't worry, it's their own fault. The people that you have fucked over for decades that are on the bottom and you're grinding them under your fucking heel, it's their own fault. Because they are morally bad people, you know, they're weak, so they're stupid.
How did that help him get elected in Ohio?
Oh, well, that's what we're going to get to, because this goes from the story of why J.D. Vance sucks to why Donald Trump sucks and why the Republican Party sucks. Vance blames hillbilly culture and its supposed encouragement of social rot. Comparatively, he feels that economic insecurity plays a much lesser role. So again, he is here to counter the progressives. And again, it was a Jew, the woman that I was telling you about, that was on Democracy Now! and you know, progressive leftists. Amy Goodman had that Jew on. I forget her name. I'll find it after the episode. But she's like, so tell me, what did you find, you know, fellow Jew? And she's like, well, fellow Jew, I studied these people and I lived among them, and they're not all bad. They're not all racist scum. And then J.D. Vance comes along. He's like, well, I'm actually one of them, and they are racist scum, and you Jews are superior, and you have your money, and the capitalists have the money because you're morally right. You know, I mean, it's just another version of the same fucking thing. But anyway, so he's blaming them, and he regularly relies on personal experience. Talks about welfare recipients, talks about this, talks about that. I mean, yeah, you're right. A white Uncle Tom. If a black person wrote a memoir like this, that's what he would be called. And his resentment of those who seemed to profit from poor behavior while he struggled, combined with his values of personal responsibility and tough love. I mean, you have the whole thing here, the Scots-Irish, the Protestant, evangelical, presented as a microcosm of the reason for Appalachia's overall political swing from strong Democratic Party to strong Republican affiliations. He recounts stories intended to showcase a lack of work ethic, including the story of a man who quit after expressing dislike over his job's hours and posted to social media about the Obama economy, as well as a coworker with a pregnant girlfriend who would skip work. And this was just hailed by everybody. In fact, the left, the hard left, was more against it than the right, because the libertarian right just is lapping this up. But like the Jacobin, it said that there in the Jacobin said that his argument relied on circular logic and eugenics, ignoring existing scholarship on Appalachian poverty, and was, quote, primarily a work of self-congratulation. So he's bragging about how he managed to get out of that. He managed to go to Yale. I hate this fucking piece of shit. Anyway, again, I have to speak about this strongly because I grew up in Appalachia. I grew up in West Virginia, and I've since the age of seven, I've been around West Virginians my whole life. And the idea that somebody could come from, and he's not even actually from the real Appalachia that he's talking about, that somebody could come to this, from this, go to the Silicon Valley, Pajits and Jews and hyper-capitalists, globalists, and tell them this about his own people that he comes from is about the most disgusting person that I can imagine.
Well, for anybody to sweep under the rug, the people who settled Appalachia, cleared the land, you know, fought Indians here, dealt with all kind of hardships, and then to have later on have timber companies, coal companies, just come in and basically, because a lot of them were illiterate, they weren't stupid, but they didn't have formal education, and just cheat them out of their land. And then when they said, hey, I got cheated, then they had Pinkerton guards move in and say, oh, no, you didn't. That was legal. You lost your father, your grandfather's, land because you signed this. It doesn't matter what you thought you were signing. This is what the law says. You don't own it anymore. And we got all these Pinkerton guards to enforce it. And just doing that kind of stuff over and over again. And to the point where, like in West Virginia, how much of the land is owned by timber companies and coal countries, and then polluting the water, that these people use, or springs and stuff. I mean, it's just, and this guy, for anybody to sweep that history under the rug, especially a guy that's from that general region, is just like indefensible.
Yes, and I think about, I mentioned this already once on this show, but I'm going to say it again, that the small town where I'm from in West Virginia, where you moved when I was a kid, it all happened in the 90s, the era of globalization. There was a shoe factory that was in this town that employed, like, it was like the biggest employer in the county, and it had been operating for many years. And this is right after the Cold War ends, in the early 90s. They close up shop and outsource it, move it to some, I don't know, Sri Lanka or something. And then right after that, and I was just talking to the father of a kid that I went to school with, who that kid suffered from drug addiction. And so many people, Jazz and I were talking about it, so many people we both went to high school with of our generation, because Jazz and I are the same age, that we went to school with have died from these overdoses. Right after this shoe factory left and suddenly all the people are unemployed, right after that you have OxyContin introduced into the area. And instead of, this guy was telling me how this area, it used to be alcohol, tobacco, and basically pot was it. And then all of a sudden you have pills and everybody's turning into a pill head. And when I think about also how the people in the Rust Belt, because I've also lived for a long time in the Rust Belt and in Appalachia, you know, West Virginia, for instance, had the highest, I don't know if it still does, but had the highest enlistment rate of any state in the Union. I mean, you talk to West Virginians, I've done a lot of, per capita, yeah. I've done a lot of, I used to work in cell phone stores in this state. It's the amount of veterans I would come across, the amount of veterans who were fucked up by the Iraq and Afghanistan war, and they weren't working public relations like J.D. Vance. They weren't doing public relations work. Guys that were crippled, screwed up, and they would come back from Iraq and Afghanistan, and they would go to the VA, and you know what the VA would do? would write him a big fat prescription for OxyContin. Oh, you got some pain, you feel bad, whatever, and get them all hooked. And because all the jobs are gone, what would they do? They'd sell their pills in the community to make a buck so they would have cash. This story, I know personally, has repeated itself over and over and over again. This was done to these people. This isn't something they did to themselves. So, that's why if I sound a little heated on J.D. Vance, I really, really despise this guy.
Well, you know, West Virginia used to have a huge glass manufacturing, leather, shoe stuff. It was all kind of manufacturing. The small farms were a big thing. There was orchards, all that stuff was, with globalization left the state, left Appalachia. And then you have a kid that is growing up here, and he's taught in school that your people were awful. You know, they stole the land from the Indians. They enslaved the blacks. Your relatives in Europe gassed the Jews. You're a terrible race. And then TV and the movies is like glorifying a lifestyle that is totally out of the reach of these people, right? And then so they get out of school. And there's no jobs, and you have all this guilt, and you wonder why people just don't care. And then this asshole comes along and says, oh, it's their own fault, and because he's willing to do anything. He has no personal morality. He's willing to do anything to climb and scratch his way out of that. And his biggest fear, our favorite uncle talks about that, a certain kind of bourgeois, that their biggest fear is sliding back into what they came from. They just crawled up a notch or two, and the thing that they fear the most is going back to just being an anonymous working class person,
Yes. Yeah. So that's how we're going to come back around to what just happened, because that's the crazy thing. If you were following when this book was released and all the chatter about this and all the crap that came out of this, and this guy's role as a big never Trumper and an anti Trumper. And now suddenly it's like the lights switch back on, and all of a sudden he just won the Ohio primary with Trump's endorsement. So what happened? What happened? Well, I just want to talk about that. The end of this Wikipedia entry on Hillbilly Elegy says a key reason for Hillbilly Elegy's widespread. By the way, hillbilly is something that is basically a racial slur against white people. I just want to say that. Hillbilly is a racial slur against white people. It's like saying nigger elegy, white nigger elegy, or whatever you want to say. I will use the term hillbilly in an affectionate way. Because I am a hillbilly. I mean, I grew up in the mountains and in the hills here.
Well, it's like niggers call each other niggers, and right. That's okay. Yeah. You can't.
I can use it. But you go to Silicon Valley and you talk to your Silicon Valley elites and you use it, and it's a racial slur against white people. But it says a key reason for Hillbilly Elegy's widespread popularity following its publication in 2016 was its role in explaining Donald Trump's rise to the top of the Republican Party. In particular, it helps explain why white working class voters became attracted to Trump as a political leader. Vance himself offered commentary on how his book provides perspective on why a voter from the, quote, hillbilly, unquote, demographic would support Trump. Although he does not mention Trump in the book, Vance openly criticized the former president while discussing his memoir in interviews following the book's release. However, Vance walked these comments back when he joined the 2022 U.S. Senate race in Ohio and now openly embraces Trump ideology. So what I'm going to do is, let me see if I can do this. I'm just going to play it over the speakers. A clip that you and I watched right before we started. This is that idiot Joe Scarborough on MSNBC. And they strung together a selection of clips of J.D. Vance saying the stuff he was saying about Trump versus the stuff he has just recently saying about Trump. So contrasting what he was saying in 2016, 2017 to what he is saying now, or what he said in this race. And we'll just listen to this and then we'll talk about it. One second. That's what the problem is. It's trying to play through the speakers. There we go.
in Ohio still gold. I mean, it made all the difference in the world for J.D. Vance. Trump still has a massive sway over perhaps it's a small base of support in the Republican Party, but whatever it is, it's certainly the more rural, the better J.D. Vance did because of that Trump endorsement. Now, J.D. Vance, the venture capitalist turned Midwest memoirist, was once extremely against Trump before he was for him, tweeted things about how much he loved Mitt Romney taking down Donald Trump. He'd go on Charlie Rose, he'd write for the New York Times. I think they profiled him on 60 Minutes. He was just, he really was the
star.
He was the elite's elite. He was, of course, an Ivy Leaguer. All these guys are Ivy Leaguers these days, aren't they? Roll Tide. Thank God I went to Alabama and Florida. But all these guys are Ivy Leaguers these days, it seems. A venture capitalist, a guy from Silicon Valley. They're talking about how grand Silicon Valley was until he left Silicon Valley with all of his money. Well, MSNBC's Ari Melber showcased some advances. Well, devolution or evolution, whichever way you want to look at it.
As somebody who doesn't like Trump, myself, the elites were right about Donald Trump, right? I'm a never Trump guy. I never liked him.
He's the best president of my lifetime, and he revealed the corruption in this country like nobody else.
I can't stomach Trump. I think that he's noxious and is leading the white working class to a very dark place.
I think that he was a good president. I think he made a lot of good decisions for people.
I think you're not a Trump supporter from what I've read. Am I right? Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah. I didn't vote for Trump.
All around, he's a great president. I'm 37 years old. Certainly the best president of my lifetime.
Consider how Vance's professional bio is basically a hit list for today's right-wing grievance culture. He was a coastal banker and a venture capitalist, an Ivy League elite from Yale Law School, a self-styled literary intellectual who mused about the dangers of right-wing extremism in magazines like The Atlantic. And then, I'm out of fingers on this hand, and then he pursued a perch within the coastal media elite, pushing a trendy book where he claimed to explain the Rust Belt in the Midwest while writing from the coasts, and then taking that tome, Hillbilly Elegy, to go spend as much time as he could talking to his fellow media elites about what were his coastal observations about the troubled rest of the nation. Vance also deleted his old tweets that slammed Trump as, quote, reprehensible, and arguing that God wants better for America than Trump.
Cultural outsider. I didn't come from the elites. I didn't come from the Northeast or from San Francisco.
You were out in San Francisco now, right?
That's right.
Working for Peter Thiel?
Yeah, I work at one of the venture capital funds that he co-founded.
The things that I care most about are not in San Francisco. They're not in Silicon Valley.
One thing led to another, and I found myself in Silicon Valley. If you think about the folks who are really, you know, building the future, building really great and cool companies, and I just wanted to be involved in that.
He's a Yale-educated lawyer, a great student, you know, went to Yale, got a law degree.
I do think that basic human honesty, even though it may not always pay off in the short term, it tends to pay off in the long term, or at least if you're not honest, it tends to pay off negatively in the long term.
I'm sick of the big tech companies censoring conservatives, shutting us up, and let's be honest, ladies and gentlemen, stealing the 2020 election.
So, it's all on tape. It's all there. He's a hypocrite. He lies. All of that.
Yeah.
But it turned out last night it doesn't matter. It
doesn't matter.
Donald Trump endorsed him. He apologized for the things he said about Donald Trump. Donald Trump said, look, if I held everybody who said something mean about me responsible for it, I wouldn't have any friends or I wouldn't have any allies in politics.
All right. We can cut it off there. Let me get your reaction now to all that first.
Well, they laid it out. They just showed what a hypocrite he is. He just went over to the other side, wherever he was from or whatever thoughts he had originally or feelings, he just abandoned them and went totally over to the other side.
Well, there's a lot to unpack here because, you know, there's several aspects of this. I don't know who to criticize first because maybe I could just criticize the voters, the white voters of Ohio. I can't criticize them too hard because I think that, I mean, the situation is that white people are, their backs to the wall. They are so desperate. They are like a drowning man. the white working class people of this country. And a guy like Trump can come around and screw them over 10 different ways and betray them, actually go back on all his promises. And because the opposition is so viscerally anti-white, almost like to a genocidal degree, hates them and wants to destroy them on a like a physical population level, and is attacking their culture in on every single level that's possible, they will still go for this guy. I mean, it's like, you know, a good analogy would be like a child who's living with an abusive father who you know, starves them, beats them, rapes them, molests them, and does all this, and then a crazy nigger axe murderer jumps in the window and is, like, chopping everyone in sight, and they call for their father to help, you know, fend off the nigger axe murderer, because they would rather, you know, the immediate thing of getting, you know, living a life of just constant abuse from your sick father would be better and preferable to getting chopped in half by a nigger axe murderer.
I think, you know, Trump in 2016, when he came onto the scene, the things he was saying were so shocking and so refreshing to millions of people that they never got over it. They just that's how they think of Trump forever. It doesn't matter what he does after that. And I think that that's part of the problem. I mean, most voters are not on Telegram or you know, listening to our podcasts in our circles and stuff. They're watching, you know, cable TV and so forth, and they follow Trump, and they show little clips of Trump saying this or that. Trump comes around when an election endorses a guy that's running that he wants. But, you know, I think despite all this anti-establishment stuff with, you know, with Trump, they're still trying to paint it that way. I think Trump has just come real close to the Republican establishment, and the Republican establishment is coming closer to Trump. They see that they really, really don't have that much, that many serious differences.
Yeah, well, that's the really interesting. That's another interesting aspect of this. So the first thing is the tragic aspect of the white voter in Ohio, who would still go with this horrible scumbag evil Republican Party. I mean, forget about J.D. Vance and his own personal record of shitting on these people, essentially. Let's just deal with Donald Trump. Like, why should Donald Trump's endorsement count for so much? It's because they are basically the Democrats are the axe murderer, nigger axe murderer climbing in their window, and the Republicans are the abusive father, I should say stepfather, because it's not even like it's not even their own people running the Republican Party who's, you know, systematically abusing and raping them on a day-to-day basis. So that's the choice, and they're going to go with the abusive father or stepfather. So you know, you say, well okay, well, why not? We have the NJP. Why aren't we throwing a third choice in? Why are we not running? We have people in Ohio. We have a lot of really great people in Ohio. Ohio and Pennsylvania is really like our strongest base of support with the NJP. So why did we run a guy against this? Well, just to give you some idea, this primary was the most expensive in Ohio's history, with the candidates spending a combined $66 million throughout the campaign. Our democracy, $66 million. So, and that's, you know, forget about ballot access. I mean, that's just if you're a Republican or a Democrat.
That's almost twice what we pay Stryker every year.
Yeah, it is. Yes, exactly. So this is a big hurdle. Now, that doesn't mean it's impossible. It can be done. A candidate, an NJP candidate or another type of candidate could get ballot access and could run against a scumbag like this. It could be done, but it would take, it's going to take a lot. It's going to take a lot. It's going
to. You don't need as much money as they have to compete with them, but you probably need at least, you know, 5% of it or something. And that's still, for us, that's a lot of money.
Yes. Yeah. And And again, this is where all the censorship, all the shutting us down, I mean, it all comes together. The purpose of it is to keep us from getting a foothold in any one area. Like, we don't need we don't need big donors. We don't need J.D. Vance's Silicon Valley donors or his big Republican Jew Sheldon Adelson type donors. We don't need them if we can get enough small donors. But in order to do that, you have to have payment processing and you also have to have reach. And so, you know, they shut that down. I don't want to get into a big thing about that, but
I just want to say the reason these kind of system candidates need so much money is they're in a funny spot. They have to try to distinguish themselves from another nothing candidate that isn't saying anything. And so it's like, you know, selling a brand of sneakers or something. It's just saturation. They need saturation money. Whereas when we get to the point where we can actually run somebody, we will get all kind of publicity that they got to pay for, like sort of the way Trump did, because of what we stand for. You know, they'll be talking about us. So we don't need nearly the kind of dollars that they have to have, because we're actually saying something.
Right. Of course.
That they can't ignore.
So, again, I don't want people to think that it can't be done. It can be done, but it's going to take a lot of work to get to that point. And, you know, we're doing it, but it's going to take a lot of work. It can't be done right now. It can't be done this year. So these people just are – this is a plutocratic system. It is a plutocracy. It is what Jack London wrote about in The Iron Heel. And that's why this kind of a thing, a race like this, is just – it's about as undemocratic as you get. So there's that aspect of it, but the other aspect of it is, and we'll get to J.D. Vance himself, the other aspect of it is Trump and how much Trump sucks, and the fact that Trump would endorse this guy. You know, the political class, they're making it sound like, oh, well, see, Trump's an opportunist. Trump will just go with any guy who you know, he thinks is a winner or something. He'll forgive anything. He just wants his name attached to it. But I think it's more the fact that J.D. Vance actually, what he was writing in Hillbilly Elegy is how the Trump family actually thinks about Rust Belt and Appalachian Americans. I mean, if you were to sit down with Ivanka Trump, all right, and really get her opinion on all the things that J.D. Vance was saying about the hillbillies that deserve what they get because they're irresponsible and dumb and stupid and immoral and they, you know, if you were to sit her down, you know she would agree with that. And Donald Trump himself probably agrees with it. Or at the very least, like, he doesn't care. Like, he doesn't care what these people are going through. He really doesn't. He just doesn't. So J.D. Vance, Trump really doesn't have a moral objection or a political objection or an ideological objection to endorsing this guy who was against him. You know, if you want to spin it as, oh, look at how broad-minded Trump is to forgive this former guy who criticized him. Well, forget about the criticisms of him. What about the criticisms of Trump's people? Trump's, I mean, that's the thing. It's not like Trump is forgiving, oh, he betrayed me, but now I'm willing to let it go. It's, no, you betrayed my people, but that's the thing. Trump doesn't see, he sees those people as something to, for his own self-aggrandizement. He does not see them, you know, it's the old Braveheart quote. You know, you think the people of this country exist to provide you with position. Ask that man about the Jews, you know, when he's drunk. But anyway, Trump views the people of this country, the white people of this country, and Ivanka really does, as something that's just there to provide him with position and with prestige and with, you know, to make him money, to make him glorious, to make his name great. He doesn't see himself as a representative or a fighter for those people. So Trump, in doing this, is just shitting all over his own people. And now, as far as J.D. Vance goes, J.D. Vance is very funny because you could say there's two things I want to say about him. The one is his character is revealed. If everything up to Hillbilly Elegy didn't reveal that this guy is nothing but a consummate opportunist and a self-promoter, a guy who will sell out everything that he's come from sell out his own people, use his grandparents and his mother and father and the community that he came from as, like, basically holding them up for the world so that all the liberal elites can tut-tut and discuss how shitty these white trash hillbillies are. The people who raised him. You know, when I'm sure if you read the book, you know, he's like, oh, you know, well, they were good and this and this and that. But essentially, that's what you're doing. Essentially, that's what you're doing. Again, that's why I don't give a shit about the nitty-gritty of what he says in the book. It's how this book, the cultural interpretation of this book, how he went along and touted this book. Because I watched many interviews with him back when he was promoting it. So you're willing to sell out your own people that you come from, shit all over them. You're willing to then join venture capitalists like bankers, so like the actual bloodsucker class that is at the heart of this whole system that is like killing your race. You marry this Indian woman of the globalist upper class so that you can not have white kids, so that you can remake your kids as like global Kamala Harris mutant world citizens. All this, you know, to go to Yale, and now the final step. He's willing even to go back on all his anti-Trump stuff if that will get him ahead. If that will get him elected to the United States Senate, he's going to reject everything that he has made his whole life about and suddenly become a big Trump populist. So, again, this guy has no principles, no conscience. He's just a utter, complete piece of shit from start to finish. But there's one other aspect of this, and that is that maybe he's not actually lying. It's funny because I'll tell you something, Dad. I knew the place I was working when in like 2018, I knew a working class white guy and a guy who was had a little more money that I came into contact with. And the working class guy voted. He was a lifelong Democrat because, like West Virginia Democrats, he was an old union Democrat, union, white working class union guy. And he voted Republican for the first time in his life in 2016 because he hated Hillary Clinton. Okay. Now, the other guy I know who's came from money and had money, he voted for Hillary in 2016 and he voted against Donald Trump. But a curious thing happened. In 2020, the white working class guy who had voted for Donald Trump because he hated Hillary was going to vote for Uncle Joe Biden. But the guy that had money decided that he was going to vote for Donald Trump. And that reversal tells you everything about Trump's 4 years in political office. The working class white people that voted for him, he sold them down the river, he betrayed them. But the old Republican establishment class, the country club class, they decided, hey, you know what? Trump isn't that bad after all. So that's the other aspect to this, is that J.D. Vance maybe is being true, in a sense, to his plutocratic Yale elite, you know, fuck over the working man principles, in that he realizes, hey, Donald Trump is an elite fuck over the working man president.
Well, it's just pretty obvious at this point that Trump in 2016 stirred up racial feeling, stirred up populist feeling solely to get the advantage over the rest of the Republican pack in the primaries. And, you know, it was sort of like an unwritten rule that you don't go there. You're playing with fire when you tap into that stuff. And Trump just did it anyway. But then after he was in, he calmed down. It's like, hey, you know, don't worry. I'm not gonna stir this stuff up to the point where it's actually gonna, you know, produce change. You know, I'm still a big Israel guy. I'm a big Wall Street guy. They became comfortable with him. And he became comfortable with them.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Yeah. So J.D. Vance sucks. we're coming up on the 1 hour mark here. J.D. Vance sucks. I'll leave it at that. It'll be interesting to see. He'll probably win in Ohio because the other segment of that was saying how Ohio is really swinging hard Republican, at least whites in Ohio.
He probably has presidential you know, aspirations at some point.
He probably does, but he...
The new Republican with his non-white wife and, you know, his working class background, but venture capitalist, you know, Ivy League.
Yeah, well, this is the kind of guy that's getting elected to the United States Senate. So we'll see. But, yeah, we should continue to dump on this guy. And when we can get things to the point with the NJP where we can really hold these guys to account, it is an indication, as they're saying here, that Trump, if he chooses to run in 2024, he's just going to clean up. There's nobody, not Ron DeSantis, and Jazz Hands has been saying this for a while, there's nobody that's going to even come close to standing in his way. So, you know, we're going to have to put up with this fake populism a little bit longer, as long as, and again, it just shows that anyone can take on the mantle of it. I mean, a guy who's literally built his whole career out of sucking up to the coastal elite, globalist, anti-white, neoliberal class and shitting on the white working class in rural Appalachia and the Rust Belt. And that guy can just overnight fly a Trump flag, get an endorsement from Donald Trump, and the people will still vote for him. So it's a shame. It's kind of tragic, but yeah. So with that, I know the first thing, the main thing we were going to talk about is the abortion issue. And Dad, I was saying that Mike and I, when we did the show the other night, our friend Keggs came up with this number about how many, I'm going to bring it up again, but how many white women every year. It was much higher than what I thought. It's still a vast majority of the abortions in this country are non-white, if you add up blacks and Hispanics together. But it's still, it was like 200 and some thousand was the number. And I want to just repeat this. I know I covered this on the Mike and Warren show, but Keggs mentioned a number here of like the number of people that were, that are born. Here it was. There's a couple points that he made. This was in the comments section on our thing. So some statistics on abortion from the New York Times in December 2021. The most surprising to him was 32% of abortions are to women who voted for Trump. 64% are to women who had at least some college. 64% are to women over 25. According to the Guttmacher Institute, 14% of abortions are to married women, and 31% are cohabitating. And he said he's willing to bet those are disproportionately white. So he makes the point here that there could be a perception that professional white women don't get abortions because they don't talk about it, that they may have done it in their when they were in college in their 20s. But he said the portion of the white population getting abortions is probably the working class and marginal portion most likely to literally breed revolutionaries. So it's really interesting because this is actually a much more devastating thing to the white population than I thought. And I know, you know, we were talking about just how our movement sort of swung around on this issue somewhat, because the old take from 2016, 2017 was, you know, this affects so many blacks. Emily was kind of posting about this on Telegram, like, you know, she doesn't want to see all those extra blacks that are getting aborted be out there in the world. Like, we got too many already running around burning down the cities and killing people. So, and that was very much the view back then. But, you know, Jazz and others have talked about how 100% of the Jewish system, 100%, is behind the Roe v. Wade, the abortion issue. And this is really, that in itself makes it something that you have to take this position against it. Now, did you want to say something on that? Because we had an experience.
Well, I just want to say, it's, I think abortion is one of those things. You have to change people's attitude towards having children. I mean, you know, it's like drugs. I mean, if you want to do drugs, you can find drugs. You can do them. You know, but if you have an attitude towards, you know, health and fitness and having a clear mind, you're going to stay away from it. And, you know, you can see in our circles where we value babies being born, and it's happening. People, you know, but that's the whole thing. I don't think it's one of those things that you can legislate, tell people that it's against the law and it's going to stop it. That's why spreading our ideas are so important. You have to make people value it. A personal thing. I was always sort of, you know, abortion wasn't a hot issue for me one way or another. As you know, back in 2016, I had a health issue where I ended up in the hospital, and for like 5 days, one foot in a grave and the other on a banana peel. I was in for 10 days total. But after I got out of the intensive care, I had like a therapist where I was like walking with a walker, trying to get my strength back. Well, on the same floor, there was a nursery there with newborn babies. And having been so sick, that was really the first time I remember walking down there, and you could look through the glass at these newborn babies. And it really hit me then that there's something wrong with ending a life like that just because it's inconvenient or it wasn't planned or something like that. I mean, when you're that sick and you're that close to crossing over the line, and then you see these little newborn babies. I mean, it really came in on me how precious life is, how fragile life is, and it kind of changed me with being really against abortion, boarding healthy, white babies.
You mean like even early on?
Yeah, even really on. I mean, and it used to be like when I was a kid. See these things of like birth control and no fault divorce and all this stuff. You know, back in the day, it was when you got married, it was thought of more as like a permanent deal. I mean, people got divorces, but it was always sort of a little scandalous a long time ago. And so people got married and they had kids. And you used to hear about a common expression was, oh, they had to get married. I mean, the girl got pregnant and they had to get married. Well, imagine now somebody having to get married because they were pregnant, but it was a thing. So you didn't screw around with somebody who, if you did get pregnant, you wouldn't be willing to marry them, so that stuff really changed the dynamics a lot, I think.
I was going to talk about. I'll get to this in a second. The one thing here was the number that Keggs posted, that it was 2,094,000 whites were born in 2016. He said we're literally being decimated by abortion because it was, it was something like 250,000 white babies killed in a single year here in 2019. So, that's a huge number. What's shocking, actually, is how low. I mean, only 2 million white. I mean, the immigration. What was it? It was 2 million immigrants came in last year, I believe. So the entire white population. See, that's the funny thing. I always put the immigration numbers. I stack it up next to like population of a city for comparison. But if 2 million immigrants came in. That's the entire, every white baby born in America, they brought in an immigrant for that white baby. So, I mean, I understand the point of view of people who don't just fixate on this issue, because we're not going to just solve this by making abortion illegal. That's not going to change the demographic imbalance. And it is true that if you stop this 250, I mean, again, leaving aside the moral question of when there's a soul, when life begins, that's a separate, I know that's a very, very important issue to a lot of people. It is something, though, that I think also could be used by the enemy as much as by in a pro-white sense, because as we know, and we don't really have to get into the history of it too much, but you and I had an experience when we were in the Reform Party that the pro-Buchanan faction, and this was my first real political encounter with the hardcore anti-abortion people. Pat Buchanan had a lot of traditional Catholic supporters and people who that was their number one issue. And after the 2000 presidential election in the Reform Party, the pro-Buchanan elements within the Reform Party split into a very ugly fight where there was elements that wanted to go 100% anti-abortion, no exceptions, not in the case of incest, rape, or of the mother's health. And over that issue of no exceptions, there was a big fight because there were a lot of other Buchananite factions we were involved with who were more with Buchanan on immigration, on trade, on, you know, Buchanan was very hard on Israel. And we felt that at the time, and I still feel, that those issues were more important than forcing this thing of like a hardcore radical no exceptions. And so that was my first encounter with that element. And I didn't like them because I saw them as single-issue fanatics who were very religiously motivated and not thinking at all in terms of what's good for society, what's good for the people. And just the idea to me that a black guy could rape a white woman and she would not be allowed to get an abortion. That reflexively for 20 years, I've been like, okay, well, screw the anti-abortion crowd. I'm not for that. I'm not a pro-lifer. Because if that's what that means, that a white woman raped by a black cannot get an abortion, if that's your religious interpretation of abortion and it should be outlawed, then I simply disagree. I think that you've taken it too far at that point.
Well, funny thing, from my observation, I remember those days, and it seemed like the most fanatical people that were against it were a lot of guys in their, you know, in their 20s or even, you know, mid to late 20s that I got the impression they never even had a girlfriend, and they were fanatically against abortion. And on the other hand, you have these, like, boomer feminist women that are fanatically poor, you know, pro-choice.
Yeah.
And so it's like two people that are about as far away from a pregnancy, the chances of a pregnancy you're going to get, were the two fanatic factions on each side.
I remember that. I remember those types. You had these, like, fat, like, pudgy conservative nerds that were so obsessed with this issue, and then you have the other side. I mean, I will say also, I am much more like that. That put, I mean, I just want to explain to the audience because that stuck it in my mind what the anti-abortion faction was, and there's no doubt, and I think Jazzle will want to talk about this, how this is one of the great, like, Finkel fights in American politics. I mean, it really dominated a lot of boomer era, like, adult boomer politics. Was abortion. And I told the story on the Mike and Warren show about the guy that we both know who was in 2000. I was telling him he should vote for Ralph Nader because he's a big environmentalist, but he was convinced that he has to vote for Al Gore and Joe Lieberman because he said to me, dead serious, if George Bush is elected, he'll take away a woman's right to choose. And so this issue has gone back and forth, and it's been used to, it's used sometimes as a proxy for white issues. And it's also used as a substitute issue for a lot of other more important issues on both the right and the left. But with all that said, this is still something that when you watch the left, the way they're reacting to this, it's beyond ghoulish. It is anti-white. It is an anti-white thing. And I wanted to go back to what you were saying about when you were growing up, how this was thought of. There's a film that when I still had Turner Classic Movies, I caught on TV that I recommend for people. It's an interesting movie. It's called Love with the Proper Stranger. And it's got Natalie Wood and Steve McQueen. And it's just an interesting cultural
like a sort of a data point, a moment in time when a certain kind of story, it's a sort of a romantic comedy, but it's got some very serious elements. It's from 1963. What were you going to say?
I saw that movie at a drive-in movie theater. I used to have like, they'd have like, you know, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, like a Disney film or something early. And then there'd be a second film for adults. And we used to go like a drive-in movie with pillows and blankets. My sister and I would, you know, would fall asleep in the back seat there. My parents would wait, but I remember, as old enough, I'd wake up, and I remember seeing some of that Love with a Proper Stranger.
That's funny. Have you watched the movie since?
I think, yeah, like 20 years ago or something. I saw.
Okay. I recommend it to people because it's basically about abortion. The movie is about abortion. And Natalie Wood, who's really, really beautiful, she plays the daughter of like a working class Italian family, and she gets pregnant, has like a one night stand with Steve McQueen, and gets pregnant, and they meet, and basically, I don't think I'm spoiling the movie. I mean, I am kind of spoiling the movie, but you should watch it anyway. It's like, okay, well, you have to get an abortion, and at that time it was illegal. So she has to go to some like scummy place, and it's a very creepy scene where they go to like this shady, shady place to get the abortion. And it's funny because he's like urging her to do it, but once they get to this place, he's so freaked out and appalled by it that, and these seedy people, that he backs out of it, and then they get talking and. Anyway, after a long thing, they finally decide to keep the baby. And it's a beautiful story because it kind of just gets at the thing of the essential idea that if two healthy white people conceive a child together, that it's like, why not keep it? Why not keep it? Why not? That's the turn your life has taken. And now what's funny about this is that the film today is actually considered almost like an argument for why abortion should be legal, because it's showing the seedy underworld of illegal abortion practices. And so people will say, well, that, you know, if abortion is outlawed, then what you're going to have is that a return to that of black market underground abortionists, and where it's much less safe, where women can die, you know, because it's being done in unsafe ways and that sort of thing. And you could make that argument from the film.
I'd be willing to guess. I've never seen any statistics or facts with this. But those unethical doctors that do that, there'd be a disproportionate number of Jews. This way, the Jews in abortion clinics now are disproportionate.
Oh, like overwhelmingly. Yeah. I mean, that's like been a talking point with the alt-right for a while. It's like a 90%. I don't know what the numbers are, but somebody can post it in the comments. Oh yeah, it's their favorite thing. I mean, it's literally like this blood sacrifice thing where they're sacrificing the Goyim children to Moloch or whatever. I mean, it's like a wholly Jewish enterprise. I mean, what kind of a doctor, you know, you sign up for that? And it's funny because they've made it specifically that it's a Jewish religious thing that they are that by outlawing abortion, America would be going against like Jewish traditional law, even though the Jews, Mike was saying, Jews don't get abortions, you know. But what I was going to say about this film is a really interesting like look at what the popular attitudes were in 1963. In the early 60s, that's like right before everything fell off the cliff.
The Civil Rights Act was passed a year later.
Yeah, exactly. So it's fascinating, but the thing I wanted to say about it is that this issue, which right now there is a Finkel fight developing over this. I mean, right now there are tons and tons and tons and tons of issues for white people to be concerned about that are like explicitly white issues, like, for instance, black crime, like, for instance, immigration, which is at an all-time high. So this issue is definitely going to – it's put –
conservatives and Republicans who were all about pressing the Biden administration on their unbelievable historic failures on inflation, you know, gas prices, immigration, crime, every metric, foreign policy, every metric, the Biden administration is failing spectacularly. And Republicans were looking forward to, in this primary, going hard on that. Now they're saying, I mean, the chatter among the political class is now the Republicans are on the defensive. Now they have to defend, you know, prosecutors prosecuting women for murder because they had an abortion and that kind of thing. Sort of creating all these scenarios, these horrific scenarios, that extreme scenarios that could come out of this. And then putting them on the defensive. And I was saying on the show I did with Mike that I think this – obviously this was, I believe, leaked by a leftist on the Supreme Court. And I think a big part of it is mobilizing the left, because the left has actually nothing to be excited about with Joe Biden. I mean, he's and with the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party, as I said, has failed on everything, not just on anti-white there were anti-white policies, but just on the policies that Democrats are supposed to care about. So like student debt relief, for instance, and so many others. The minimum wage, the fact that the wages were going up, now inflation has totally wiped out wage gains. I mean, working people, their lives suck right now. The environment is – things are getting worse. Biden has not delivered on any of the things that Bernie Sanders, for instance, was running on. So there's no reason for progressives or liberals, unless you're just really one of those woke people that's excited about the first black lesbian White House press secretary, and that's more important to you than, you know, a clean environment or rights for working people, living wage. There's no reason for people to come out and vote Democrat in this primary or in this midterm, rather. So this issue is mobilizing those people. And it's funny because I said that and then I caught a Jimmy Dore clip where he was saying that exact thing, that this issue is – because apparently there's something that's been – he was talking about something that's like a law that the Senate could have passed or the Congress could have passed that would have more made abortion like a legislative thing, that it's enshrined, the right to an abortion is enshrined in American law, and the Democrats have not touched this. They've just not dealt with this for all this time, and they've left this Roe v. Wade thing in limbo where it could be overturned because it wasn't actually their, you know, they don't care about protecting a woman's right to choose. So that was the angle there, you know. I mean, if there's one universal rule in American politics, it's that neither party gives a shit about the stuff they say that they care about. But what I was going to say was that, yeah, you have to watch out those aspects of this issue. And like I say, if you're looking at from a demographic standpoint, leaving the religious arguments aside, and you say there are 2 million whites that were born in 2016, let's say that's the same number being born now, and if you add theoretically another 250,000 to that, which it probably wouldn't be that many because there would be, you know, a lot of probably a lot more careful use of contraception. White people are more high agency than blacks and Hispanics generally, particularly blacks. So I would guess that what would happen is whites would be more careful, more diligent about using contraception versus the blacks who would not. So probably the black birth rate would see more of a jump than the white birth rate. You want to say something?
Well, I just want to say that, you know, a pregnancy to an unwed mother back in the day, I mean, I know of a case of somebody who got pregnant and had an abortion, and you know, either went to one of these places like in the movie you're describing, excuse me, or if you wanted to go to a better place, it was like a big scandalous thing. So you had to have a little bit of money to, you know, go out of town somewhere and have the connections. And it took, you know, if you were from a family that had a little more money and agency, you could find a safe place to get an abortion. But it was a big deal, and it was a kind of a scandalous thing and all that. So a lot of people would just figure, just get married, have the baby, you know.
Right.
So, yeah.
That's interesting. Well, yeah, what I was going to say about it was just that I thought of two aspects when I was thinking about this issue today. I thought of two aspects of it that like a kind of a test for conservatives and for liberals that would reveal people's morality on this. And this really gets at the problem because, I mean, this is a good thing. There's no doubt about it that this Roe v. Wade would be overturned. It's a good thing. The Jews are really, really mad about it. And despite all the other issues, it's overall a plus versus a minus. But what you said earlier was really true, that you had to change people's attitudes. And this is the problem here, is that this issue, first of all, the abortion issue is one that is always framed in the classic American, like classically liberal American terms of individual rights. So how do they describe it? The right to life versus
the right to choose.
And I just want to say I've always rejected that framing of this issue because I think that the, you know, from a National Socialist standpoint, or even from just a basic common good standpoint, the welfare of the group comes before the rights of any individual. I mean, this is the principle. This isn't, Hitler didn't just invent this principle. It's the principle that basically every army unit runs by in the history of warfare. It's the principle that governs tribes and societies on the most primitive level, that the whole group, the social whole, if it is not doing well, then the individual will suffer. And you cannot, for the sake of the individual, just destroy what's good for the group. All right? Gemeinnütz geht für Eigennütz. So I don't think that the abortion issue should primarily ever be framed in those terms. I think if you are framing it in those terms, you are already kind of losing. Because that means that the broader worldview of the society is flawed, is wrong, is based on, you know, individualism, essentially. And this is where, and well, yeah, go ahead.
Well, as I say, it relates to a word that's totally out of fashion, and that's duty.
Yes.
Or an honor, you know. These are concepts that people have just totally lost, you know. Right.
So with that in mind, here's two. I mean, you could actually, if you want to challenge liberals or conservatives, because right now probably this is what you're going to find: white people all across America that are polarized on this issue, and the conservatives are digging in, and the liberals are digging in. If you want to make people think and get them out of this Finkelthink kind of mindset, and sort of challenge the assumptions that are underpinning their position on this issue. Oh, I'm either for a woman, it's her body, her choice, or, oh my goodness, this fertilized egg has an absolute right to life. It's murder in any case, even if it's like I say, the black, you know, yeah, George Floyd, yeah, rapes a white woman, it's still murder.
There was a case for a retroactive abortion.
Well, yeah, that's the other thing is with talking about J.D. Vance, like switching to abortion right after J.D. Vance. I mean, there's a guy that I think it would be morally justified had his mother aborted him. But anyway, what I was going to say was just that. right. No, but what I was going to say was that the test that you could set up for people that would challenge them to get out of just the basic Finkelthink individualism, you know, her right versus the unborn's right, and make them think about the broader issues. The first test I would say for liberals, and this is if liberals were to make a movie or tell a story about the horrors of what will happen if we take away a woman's right to choose, it would go something like this. It would consist of a woman who is not allowed to go to a safe, legal abortion clinic that has all kinds of standards, and like Love with a Proper Stranger, she is forced to go to some back alley, scummy place and have it done there because and then she gets some kind of terrible sepsis or something and dies because she had have to go to a illegal underground abortion. So that would be like sort of the horror story that someone that is pro choice would say this is like a worst case scenario. But I would say this: if this is really so horrible, why can't you just make your story about a woman who has a baby? Like, why can't you make your, that's your, she doesn't want to have a baby, but she has to have it because it's illegal for her to not, to terminate the pregnancy. So this is the thing, because one thing that has added a lot of nuance to my view on this since, you know, our days of the fighting those religious fanatics in the Buchanan reform movement was, it's just that I've been around a lot more babies now, including my own, but also a lot of babies of friends. I know so many friends that have had babies, and I know a lot of young mothers who have had babies, and I can't think of one that has regretted it or would regret it. And it's amazing. A lot of women, when they have a baby, they're transformed. I mean, literally, they're transformed. Like, in the process of pregnancy, their body undergoes changes. That you could take a woman who never wanted to have a child and she becomes a mother, like physically and mentally and emotionally, in the process of carrying the baby to term and giving birth and then raising her little one. So that's the interesting thing there, is that if you really believe in this, if you really believe in this idea of pro-choice, you know, take it away from just the idea of rights and let's go with that worst case scenario. Because if you're so worried about the woman dying from sepsis, from an illegal abortion, then just have the baby. Just have the baby. Then you don't have to worry about it. Don't worry about the guy, you know, the guy in the back alley, like the guy that operates on Jack Nicholson's face in Batman, you know, in the Joker, the plastic surgeon that's there with in the crummy back alley, you know. You don't have to go there to get the abortion. Just don't get the abortion. Have the baby. I mean, especially if you think you might die. Isn't having a baby better than dying of sepsis or something? So have the baby, and that's what I would say.
And you will become attached to it.
You will become attached to it, and that's my point to the That's what I would say to the pro-choice crowd if I was going to try to persuade them. It's like, if you are really so worried about this, then show a worst-case scenario of a mother who has a child and doesn't want it. Can you do that? Can you make a film where a woman has a baby and now she's the sympathetic character because she's holding her little baby to her breast and it's shitting and it's crying and she has to wake up every 2 hours to feed it and it's changing diapers and she's just not happy and the father's not around. You know, it was a one-night stand, whatever, and she's miserable. And now make a story where she's looking at her little baby and she's saying, God, I wish I'd gotten an abortion. If only I had had the ability to abort this baby. The funny thing is, you can't do that. If you made a film like that, the woman, any mother that you portray in the movie with her baby, actively wishing she had aborted the baby after the baby is born and after she's holding the baby, would seem like a monster. And she would be an unsympathetic character.
And the movie wouldn't even have to go all the way to the point where that woman is someday dying of old age, and on her deathbed, her loving child is there by her side instead of like a Somali nurse.
Right. Well, I mean, it's just women, the nurturing thing kicks in with a woman, even if she grows up, you know, hating her child. I don't think any woman, because it's so instinctive, it's so fundamental and basic. Motherhood is just so encoded. I mean, dogs and rats and every type of like mammal feels this instinct. I mean, not just mammals, birds that are like little reptilian evolved from dinosaurs. I mean, it's the most basic thing. You'd have to be like an earthworm, a creature that doesn't even have a brain, before you would not see this motherhood instinct. I mean, it's in every form of just slightly advanced life. So that would be my thing if I was going to put this to a pro-choice person. I would say, why, if this is so horrible, the idea that the woman can't have the abortion, why, instead of showing her dying from an illegal abortion, why not just show her obey the law and she has the baby? And then show that, portray that, and here's your worst-case scenario, your horror scenario, and make the argument now. If you have the strength of conviction, if you really think that that woman's life is now destroyed by having this baby, prove it. You know, make that case. They can't do it. And that's why, like I say, I think in what that type of argument is doing, and you could make other arguments that are similar to that, is taking this away from the individualistic religious kind of mindset of that this fertilized egg has a soul and an absolute right to life, and you have to sacrifice your career, your happiness, whatever, because you had an accident, you accidentally got pregnant, now it's all out the window. You as a woman have no rights because this right comes before that. Making that individual right, trying to pit that individual right over the woman's individual right, take it out of that context. Take it out of that context and make it about the process of creating a family, of motherhood, of the role of motherhood. It's interesting because, and this is going to, I'm going to bring this now around to the conservative test. Conservatives don't want to make that argument. They don't make that argument. I mean, some do, I'm sure. I'm sure there are, you know, religious groups out there that are trying to, like the suicide prevention helpline, that are trying to convince people don't do this. But the thing that you will not see, if we are to change, because attitudes have changed on abortion since the 1960s, since Roe v. Wade. Attitudes have changed, and you see it in opinion polls. And abortion is way more accepted than it was before. And the feminist propaganda and everything has made it into this issue where it's like, in order to be a woman that's a real woman, you have to be for abortion, which is so ironic because, like, motherhood is the one thing that women not only can do better than men, but it's like the thing that they alone can do. It's the one thing that makes women absolutely, unequivocally supreme over men. Like the one area where women absolutely have it over men in every possible respect is the fact that only a woman can grow a new life in her. I mean, when my son was born, I had that thought. I thought this is a woman's equivalent of fighting and dying on a battlefield for a man, or risking his life on the battlefield. It's like men are good for many things besides war, but in war, a man's like the crowning thing of what it means to be a man. It happens in that moment of fighting for his people, and risking his life for it in war. And I thought that's what it is for women with childbirth. In that moment, that's like the crowning achievement of being a woman. So again, it's very ironic that is classic Jew propaganda that they've turned this, the denial and the destruction of that thing that makes you great is what makes you, now that's your badge of identity as a woman. But what I would say to conservatives is, and this is the test for them, if anybody's getting really hopped up on this issue, it's like, okay, well, would you acknowledge that people's attitudes are a problem, okay? That people have bad attitudes about this. And would you be in favor of state propaganda to change those attitudes? So what I mean by that is, if the state were to promote white motherhood as an ideal, and I'm not talking about saying that, you know, blacks and Hispanics, it doesn't matter if they exterminate themselves or whatever, but only whites are in value. I'm not saying that. I'm saying, though, just promoting white motherhood. Whites have the lowest birth rates in the United States, right? I think they do, of all the major demographic groups. Well, yeah, in the world especially. But, I mean, white American women have a slightly higher birth rate than a lot of European countries, sadly. I mean, sad for those European countries. But still, our birth rate is declining as white people. So if whites have the lowest birth rate in the United States, then why, as a conservative, wouldn't you be in favor of propaganda and programming and marketing designed to promote the ideal of white motherhood as a thing in itself, as a value in itself, or of white families? And this goes back to the old point that liberals used to make, progressives, I should say, that conservatives want to force women to have an abortion and then want to cut off everything else, their ability to survive after that. And that's a very valid point. I've always thought that was a very strong point. The old Republican Party, the Republican Party of George Bush, for instance, or the you know, during the Tea Party years, the hyper-capitalist trickle-down economics, Reagan, you know, Republican Party of Ayn Rand, you know, of what's his name? Who was the Andrea Mitchell's husband? I'm thinking of Greenblatt. Greenspan, Alan Greenspan. You know, he was a big disciple of Ayn Rand and her brand of – yeah. So if you take that idea of anti-socialism, anti-welfare, anti, you know, screw the working class, Atlas Shrugged, you know, let the capitalist Jew grind every last cent out of the worker, and if the worker can't fight back, that's his problem. You couple that with this, then, this religious thing that, well, you have to have the child. I mean, the fact is that a lot of couples in this country are struggling to make it. Even young millennial couples, I mean, they don't even have kids yet, and they're both working, and they're struggling to make it. They can't even afford to buy a house. So, you know, economically, the Republican Party makes it very, very difficult for young families to start. And there are a lot of white people who do. I'm sure, Dad, that Mike and I were talking about this, that there are a high percentage of white abortions that happen because white couples are looking at their credit report, are looking at their debt payments, their student loan payments, their car payments, their mortgage payments, and they're saying, if we have this child, you're going to have to quit. One of us is going to have to quit work, or we're going to have to pay daycare, and we can't afford either. So we'll put it off for another 2-3 years, 4 years, 5 years, and then they have the abortion for financial. And you know that blacks are not doing that. Blacks are they default on their student loan debts, and they knock each other's up, and they get pregnant, and they have the kid. So I was talking about with Mike how debt and usury actually is having this dysgenic effect, because the more high agency whites that think ahead would be the ones most likely to have an abortion. It was shocking there with Keggs posted about the number of married couples or cohabitating couples that are having abortions because they convince themselves that they can't afford it.
You know, it's funny. You can't compare it exactly, but like your grandfather's generation, all those East Europeans I knew back then, I mean, they're almost all poor, but they all had, you know, 6, 8, 10 kids, and the kids went, a lot of them raised on farms, you know, back, I forget what percentage of the American population lived on farms. I think it was like 70% in the 1920s or something. But anyway, you know, they went barefoot all summer. It was typical for the boys, you know, 3-4 of the boys asleep in the, a lot of times in the same big bed, you know, or something, or one room. And they just had the kids, and they were poor, but they, you know, they raised gardens, and they ate. Nobody starved. They made at Christmas time, a kid got maybe one present. It was a big deal, an orange or something. I remember it was a big deal if you lived in Pennsylvania. You know, you get an orange at Christmas. You couldn't just go in a store and buy them all year round. And people were just satisfied with a lot less. But they made music. A lot of them played instruments. They would get together. You know, they made wine, so they drink their wine and make music, and they were great memories. Those guys, they all had fond memories of their youth, and it was poverty, and it was a lot of kids, and it was all, you know, most of them were all Catholics. That's one thing I'll say for the Catholic Church for centuries. They, you know, they preached against premarital sex and they, you know, the sacrament of marriage and everything, but if there was a child born out of wedlock, they did provide some kind of help, you know. So they didn't just, like modern-day conservatives, fiscal conservatives, just cut them loose, you know.
Right. Well, that's it. It's I mean, obviously, you can make it. You can survive. It's impossible to. It's basically impossible to starve to death in America today, and you can survive, and you can make it with a child. And a lot of people.
If you really want to have kids, find that sweet spot where your income is just below where you can qualify for all the free government freebies, because they're not to the point yet where they say, oh, you don't qualify because you're white, you know. So I mean, that's how a lot of these non-whites are doing it. They're getting a bundle of food stamps and all kind of help when they're electric and their fuel and there's ways to do that if you want to go that route. It's not for everybody, but
well, a lot of people in our movement have figured that out. I mean, people that are they don't fall for the consumerist lie that you have to be, you know, have this much and be this much out of debt before you can start thinking about having kids. But my point with the conservatives, though, is because, you know, I mean. You know, conservative businessmen, I'm sure, would be happy to say, well, yeah, why don't you just go without all the modern conveniences and go around barefoot and eat one orange a year, and that way you can afford to have a kid. You're just financially irresponsible if you choose not to do that. We shouldn't have to choose these things. My point is just with conservatives, it's like, do you think that motherhood has value? Do you think that white motherhood has value? Do you think that more white babies has an objective value? Like right now, we have a situation where we have the statistic right there, like 2 million whites born in the country and so many abortions and all that. Do you want to see, because this is the thing, if you're against abortion, you can outlaw abortion, but first of all, you're not going to be able to outlaw it in every state. And so it'll be legal in half the states, illegal in the other half. So people will be crossing state lines to go to the abortion clinics. If you don't change the fundamental values that people have, then you're going to have a situation where either somehow abortion will be made legal again, or the same number of white women are going to be getting abortions. Or they're just going to start using contraception more diligently, you know, planning ahead a little bit, more careful about pregnancy than they were before. And like I say, that would disproportionately affect white people because white people have the agency to do that. So that would be my point for Republicans and conservatives. It's like, do you think that this is worth changing people's attitudes on, changing people's mindset towards families and children? Because I'll tell you something else about the sort of J.D. Vance view of the world. I don't know if he personally would say this, especially not now because he's a Trump guy, but I know that there was an element of white, affluent whites, especially the kind that crawl up from poverty and now they're making it, when they look to blame white people for their own problems, one of the metrics that they used to point to was out of wedlock births. Or I mean I remember this, I'm sure other millennials remember this. I was born in 1982, so those of you out there who were born in the early 80s, okay, you remember when we were all graduating high school and we were going off to college and all the women were going off to college, and you'd have that local girl in your town that instead of going to college, she got pregnant. And there was a thing that you would see happen where people would talk about it instead of like, oh, wow, that's amazing. You know, she's going to have a baby. I mean, it's great, those other girls that are going off to college, but this one, she really is doing, she's doing the crowning achievement here of life and of motherhood. She's actually going to become a mother, which is much more valuable, you know, the attitude of the community. No, when in the Sex and the City I use that show as the – that's always my go-to, like, ultimate example of the kind of Jewish career woman making lots of money in New York, buying expensive shoes and handbags, living the glamorous life, eating out at fancy restaurants, and then dating and screwing, riding the cock carousel of a lot of high-powered lawyers and other successful, attractive men, and just doing this forever. Because you're never going to get old as a woman. You're never going to lose the sexual desirability that you have in, like, when you're 25. That's what the message of these shows, which, by the way, Sex and the City, you probably didn't know, but it is written for women, and it's the main character is a Jew, a woman who plays her. She's a sex columnist, and it's about four women. But the creator of the show was a gay Jewish man. Really funny. But that attitude that was so promoted, particularly, like I say, like Gen X girls and early millennials, the attitude, the cultural attitude was, if a girl gets pregnant, it's like, oh, wow, what a loser. She screwed up. She screwed up her future. And there are probably among Republicans, among well-to-do Republicans, like middle class on up, you would have a lot of people that will signal about, oh, I'm pro-life. That's an important moral issue to me. But if their daughter or their son gets with a girl at a young age, at 18, 19, before they go to college, before they have a career, before they have their income lined up, and somebody gets pregnant, there's the attitude of, you fucked up, you screwed up, you loser, what are you doing? You know, you either need to get it. Yeah, it would either be you need to get an abortion, or it's like, if you don't, well, we can't now because but you screwed up. Instead of it being like, congratulations, you just did the most important thing you could possibly do for our family, for our nation. The most important thing, way more important. I mean, it's an old point of that Hitler made about women. He said that. The idea, this was a little clip that used to be floating around online. He said, the idea that we are against women getting an education or women having a job, a career, is wrong. He says, there are professional women in Germany. We're not against a woman, especially a single woman who's out there. We're not against her going out there trying to earn her daily bread, basically. But he said, I have to say, though, that from the eternal point of view of our people, a woman who goes and becomes even the most accomplished, you know, lawyer or something like that, versus a woman who has 3, 4, 5 kids, he says, from the eternal point of view of our people, that other woman, the mother, is infinitely more valuable. And it's funny because we're coming up on Mother's Day. When it'll be Mother's Day when people are listening to this. So it's a good time with Mother's Day. Mother's Day, I think it became a holiday in West Virginia. What's the town? I forget the town, but I've been through there. They have a shrine to the mother. I'm thinking of Philippi. It's a town over from Philippi. And when Mother's Day became a holiday, a national holiday, it's from, I think, that same period where, you know, it was being promoted in the Third Reich. The ideal of motherhood, it's an interesting thing, Mother's Day, because it forces liberals to choose. It's like, you want to be pro-woman? Well, here's a whole holiday dedicated to the most important thing that women can do, which is become mothers. The most sacred and the highest thing that a woman can do. And for conservatives, it's also the same thing. It's like, stop making it about just the, you know, right to life of, like I say, I say the fertilized egg. I use that as an extreme example. Obviously, late term abortion and everything is fucking murder. But I'm talking about very early, first trimester, very early abortion, where it's more morally, you know, ambiguous, unless you have a very strong religious conviction about this. But if you make it just about that, this absolute right, instead of the broader context of, is motherhood valuable? Are families valuable? Are white people, more white people, is that an actual value? I think conservatives who say they're pro-life need to be put to that test and say, you know, Are you for promoting this? Would you be against promoting this? Is there? Will you acknowledge that more white babies and more white families and more white women becoming mothers is an absolute moral good, a positive value in the world?
Our dear Hungarian friend, he put it this way. He said, if a woman wants to have a career, and there are women who have a strong calling for music or whatever, Hannah Reich, you know, maybe you want to fly airplanes. But he said, fine. He said, but first show me how you're going to, you know, bring in the next generation. You know, do your part to bring in the next generation for the nation. Because only you can do that, you know? And so anything else you want to do, fine. But, you know, show us how you're going to do your duty first.
Right. So, yeah, we're actually going to have to close it out a little early here. I'm sorry about that, guys. But
I just want to say one more thing about the mother. You know, I'll sit at, like, sometimes I'll go to Walmart or something in a parking lot before I get out of car in front of me. And I see these mothers. I've seen this a number of times where a woman will get out of the car and she gets a little kid out that's maybe like 3 or 4 years old or something. And then she's trying to watch that little kid so the kid doesn't run out in front of another car or something, keep the kid close. And she's getting another one out of a car seat. And then she, you know, puts them in a cart and with, you know, one in her hand and the other in a cart. And they just look like, you know, the father's working or something. She's there shopping. And I've often looked at those women and thought, yeah, they're the unsung heroes of today because they're not held up like they should be. They're bringing in the next generation. It's hard. It's a lot easier to just be, you know, get an abortion and having fun and you know, but these women are sacrificing a lot to do their duty, and it's very, very touching when you say, I don't take that for granted when I see women, you know, doing that.
Yeah, no, me neither. And, no, I totally agree with that. And, yeah, so, like I say, we're going to have to close this one out a little early. I'm shortchanging you guys a little bit, but I got to get this to Jazz, who on the road is going to tack on the music and get it all ready to go. We got a late start here recording today. We're on Hungarian time. But I was going to say, though, that on this issue, yeah, happy Mother's Day to everybody out there. Honor, though, not only your mother or if you're married and the mother of your children, but remember, I think that we should emphasize that Mother's Day is we are honoring all mothers. We are not just honoring you know, our immediate mother. And again, this is part of what I'm saying is we have to shift people's thinking away from just this individualistic context where it's about me and mine to where it's about ours, where it's about the whole group, the whole people. Mother's Day should be a celebration of motherhood as a whole, which, again, if you are a conservative should be put to that, what are you willing to do for mothers out there? First of all, like I said, do you think that more whites having babies is a good thing? Make them answer that question. You know, relative to other people's, because our birth rate is declining. But second of all, what are you willing to do for mothers? You know, we could talk about the points in the National Justice Party platform where we're talking about support for families and the inspiration of what the Third Reich did. And Hungary has adopted the same policy, and there's other countries in the world that these pronatalist policies where we're going to make you a low-interest loan to get a house and then cancel the debt as you know, do you believe in debt cancellation for young parents?
So it becomes financially advantageous to have children instead of, you know, a disadvantage.
Right. So as a conservative, are you willing to cut the, you know, fuck the free market and fuck capitalism for the sake of motherhood? Because if you're not willing to do that, then you're not actually pro-life. You're not actually, you're just a religious fanatic that's a spurg about some issue. But if you are not willing to take, yeah, you're virtue signaling too. If you're not willing to take the resources of the state and put them at the benefit of young children and of mothers and of struggling families out there, and you're not willing to cut out the capitalist middleman, it's making it impossible for people to to just have a normal standard of living and raise a family. Even if they're, forget about lower class economically, I mean, I'm talking about middle class people. The middle class doesn't exist anymore. Hold them to that standard. This conversation about abortion is a good time to start these kinds of points. And like I say, for the on the liberal side of it, it's to just, in the celebration of motherhood, and to question this thing of like, okay, well, you know, if you're worried about illegal abortions, mothers dying from illegal abortions, then just have the baby. What is so horrible about that? How is that a horror story that makes your point? Show me mothers that are there with babies that wish they had aborted their baby and that hate their child. I mean, you know, that type of attitude is someone who's, like, mentally ill, who's insane. You lock them up. So, yeah, I would just say to this is dominating our issues. It's dominating the national conversation right now. If you're dealing with liberals, you're dealing with conservatives, I would say try to take this issue and recontextualize it to get people thinking about the larger social good, to get them thinking about race and families and motherhood, and not just individual rights on one side or the other.
One thing they can all agree on, no matter which side of the issue you're on, is you're glad that your mother didn't have an abortion.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's true. That's very true. All right, guys. So I'm going to close this up, like I say, a little early. We will be back next week. Jazz will be back next week, and we're going to have a lot to talk about. And I'll be back on Thursday, the Mike and Warren show. Dad, thanks for coming back on. I always love that you and I come as a unit, so I always have a co-host if I need to. TRS made a good decision here.
Well, happy Mother's Day to every good mother out there.
Yeah, happy Mother's Day, guys. Take care.
Team at Antelope Hill is proud to announce the release of a new historical translation. In his own words, a collection of Adolf Hitler's essential speeches. Translated, annotated, and with extensive background sections by C.J. Miller, this collection is sure to be part of the nationalist canon for years to come. Out of the incredible number of speeches given by our favorite uncle, we narrowed it down to only the most impactful, insightful, and unjustly overlooked materials. This perfectly sized volume is great for when you're tired after a long day and you just want to kick back and read in your comfy chair. We don't need to tell you how significant these works are to our history and to our future. If you're hearing this, it's for you. Antelope Hill is proud to bring the English reader this accessible, freshly translated collection and to contribute in our own way to the legacy of this legendary man. Get In His Own Words today at antelopehillpublishing.com.
Dominance, control, authority, hegemony, these are all synonyms of the word supremacy. And anybody following thekosherquestion.com can see that the kosher certification industry enjoys all of these words and more as they pertain to the primary American marketplace for sustenance, the supermarket. If you're an American consumer wishing for some simple religious or personal liberty when you shop for food and cooking supplies, well, guy, you're just out of luck. Unless you want to become the grocery dissident, you'll be forced to support the religious organizations that impose their will their laws, and ancient particularism on almost every packaged item we buy. Peanut butter, food wrap, milk, dish soap, oatmeal, coffee, tea, sugar, flour. For all these items and more, much more, you will likely not find name-brand products free from religious intermediaries and kosher intervention. And that is because you are living under a kosher supremacy. But there is hope. The NKC community is growing, a place where you can find products that are not kosher certified and proclaim Occidental al natural. Because it's only natural that we've come to this point where we hashtag go free as we learn more from thekosherquestion.com.
Ha ha ha!